Said to Wilde, "So this is a fling?"
"Layla could never be a fling, you know that."
Hester did know.
"So you spend the whole night?"
"No, never."
So, she thought, he really was the same.
"And Layla is okay with that?"
Wilde replied by asking a question of his own.
"How did you figure it out?"
"About you and Layla?"
"Yes."
"The house was too tidy."
Wilde didn't respond.
"You're a neat freak," she said.
That was a polite understatement.
Hester didn't understand official diagnoses or any of that, but Wilde had what a layman might consider obsessive-compulsive disorder.
"And Layla is anything but."
"Ah."
"And then I found a long brown hair on David's pillow."
"It isn't David's pillow."
"I know. You snooped in her bedroom?"
"I shouldn't have."
"Yes."
"I'm sorry, it's just weird."
"You get that, right?"
Wilde nodded.
"I get it.
I want Layla happy.
I want you happy."
She wanted to add that David would want that too, but she couldn't. Probably sensing her discomfort, Wilde changed topics.
"So tell me what's up with Matthew," Wilde said.
She filled him in on the Naomi Pine issue. He watched her with those piercing blue eyes with the gold flakes. He barely moved as she spoke. Some had nicknamed him, probably still nicknamed him, Tarzan, and the moniker fit almost too well, as though Wilde were playing into that role, what with the build and the dark skin and the long hair. When she finished, Wilde said,
"Did you tell Layla about this?"
She shook her head.
"Matthew asked me not to."
"Yet you told me."
"He didn't say anything about you."
Wilde almost smiled. "Nice loophole you found there. A corollary of my occupation. Love me for all my faults." Wilde looked off.
"What?"
"They're pretty tight," Wilde said, "Layla and Matthew."
"Why wouldn't he want her to know?"
"That's what I'm wondering." They sat back in silence. When he was 18 years old, Wilde had gone to West Point, where he finished with all kinds of honors. The whole Crimstein clan, Hester, Ira, all three boys, had taken the 45-minute drive to the United States Military Academy for Wilde's graduation. Wilde then served overseas, mostly in some kind of special force. Hester could never remember what it was called. It was secret stuff, and even now, all these years later, Wilde couldn't or wouldn't talk about it. Classified. But in a song with a too familiar refrain, whatever Wilde saw over there, whatever he did or experienced or lost, war had pushed him over the edge, or maybe, in his case, it had awoken the ghosts of his past. Who's to say? When he finished serving and returned to Westville, Wilde gave up the pretense of trying to assimilate into normal society. He started working as a private investigator of sorts at a security firm called Craw, with his foster sister Rola, but that didn't really pan out. He bought a small trailer-like dwelling that brought minimalism to a new level and lived off the grid in the foothills of the mountains. He moved the dwelling around a bit, though he was always within shouting distance of that road. Hester didn't understand the technological minutiae of how Wilde knew when he had visitors. She just knew it had something to do with motion detectors and sensors and night cameras.
"So why tell me about this?" Wilde asked.
"I can't be out here all the time," she said. "I have court in the city, I have the TV appearances, obligations, stuff like that."
"Okay.
And who would be better at tracking down a missing person than you?"
"Right."
"And then there was that hair on the pillow."
"Got it."
"I haven't been there for Matthew enough," Hester said.
"He's doing fine,
except he thinks a girl who's been missing from school is in serious danger."
"Except that," Wilde agreed.
When Tim made the turn, they both spotted Matthew walking away from the house. It was a teenage walk, head down, shoulders hunched protectively, feet scraping the ground, hands jammed aggressively deep into his jeans pockets. He had white AirPods in his ears and didn't hear or see them until Tim nearly cut him off with the car. Matthew pulled out one of the earpieces. Hester stepped out of the car first. Matthew said, "Did you find Naomi?" When he spotted Wilde getting out of the passenger door, Matthew frowned.
"What the..."
I told him, Hester said. He won't say anything.
Matthew turned his attention back toward his grandmother.
Did you find Naomi? I spoke to her father. He said she's fine, that she's visiting her mother.
But did you talk to her?
The mother?
Naomi?
Not yet, no.
Then maybe her dad is lying, Matthew said.
Hester looked over at Wild.
Wild stepped toward him.
Why would you think that, Matthew? Matthew's gaze darted everywhere but on theirs.
Could you just, make sure she's okay?
It was Wild who moved closer to the boy, not Hester.
Matthew, look at me.
I am.
He wasn't.
Are you in trouble? Wild asked.
What? No.
Talk to me then.
Hester stayed back. Here was the main reason she worried so about this new relationship between Layla and Wild. It wasn't about David's memory and the pain of him being forever gone, or at least not only about that. Wild was Matthew's godfather. When David died, Wild had been there. He answered the call, stepped up his role in Matthew's life. He wasn't a father or stepfather or anything like that, but Wild was there, more as an involved uncle, and Hester and Layla had been grateful, believing, sexist as this might sound, that Matthew still needed a man in his life. How would the romantic relationship between Layla and Wild affect Matthew? The boy wasn't stupid. If Hester saw the signs in a few minutes, Matthew had to know about the romance, too. So how was the boy handling his godfather shacking up some nights with his mother? What would happen to Matthew if the relationship went south? Were Layla and Wild mature enough to make sure Matthew didn't get hurt in the fallout? Or were they being naive in their thinking? Matthew was taller than Wild now. When the hell had that happened? Wild put a hand on the boy's shoulder and said, "Talk to me, Matthew."
"I'm going to a party."
"Okay."
"At Crash's house. Ryan, Trevor, Darla, Trish, they'll all be there."
Wild waited.
"They've been picking on her more lately. On Naomi."
Matthew closed his eyes.
"Super cruel stuff."
Hester joined them.
"Who's been picking on her?"
"The popular kids."
"You?" Hester asked.
He kept his eyes on the ground.
Wild said, "Matthew."
Matthew's voice, when he finally spoke, was soft.
"No."
He hesitated.
They waited.
"But I let it happen. I didn't do anything. I should have. Crash and Trevor and Darla played a prank on her, a mean one. And now she's gone. That's why I'm going to Crash's party, to see if I can learn anything."
"What kind of prank?" Hester asked.
"That's all I know."
A car, driven by one teen with another riding shotgun, pulled up to them. The driver honked the horn.
"I have to go," Matthew said. "Please, just keep looking too, okay?"
"I'm having someone from my office trace down Naomi's mother," Hester said.
"I'll talk to her."
Matthew nodded.
"Thanks." "Is there anyone else we should talk to, Matthew? A friend of Naomi's, maybe?"
"She has no friends.
A teacher, a family member?"
He snapped his finger and his eyes lit up.
"Miss O'Brien."
Wild said, "Ava O'Brien?"
Matthew nodded.
"She's like an assistant art teacher or something."
"And you think?" Hester asked.
The driver honked the horn again.
Hester silenced it with a glare.
"I gotta go. I'm hoping to learn something at the party."
"Learn what?" Hester asked.
But Matthew didn't reply. He hopped into the back seat of the car. Wild and Hester watched them drive away.
"You know this Miss O'Brien?" Hester asked Wild.
"Yes."
"Should I ask how?"
Wild said nothing.
"That's what I thought. Will she talk to you?"
"Yes."
"Good."
When the car disappeared around the bend, Hester asked,
"What do you think?"
"I think Matthew isn't telling us everything."
"Maybe Naomi's mother calls me back. Maybe she lets me talk to Naomi."
"Maybe," Wild said.
"But you don't think so?"
"No, I don't think so." They both turned and looked down the cul-de-sac toward the Krimstein homestead.
"I have to get back to the city to do my show," Hester said.
"Uh-huh."
"I don't have time to get into this with Layla now."
probably best, Wild said. Do your show. I'll talk to Layla. Then I'll talk to Ava O'Brien.
Hester handed him a business card with her mobile number on it. Stay in touch, Wild.
You too, Hester.
Chapter 6 When Layla answered the front door, she asked, What's wrong?
Nothing.
Then why are you using the front door?
Wild always came in through the back door, always. He hiked through the woods that came up behind the Krimstein house. He'd been doing that since the days David sneaked him inside when they were little boys.
Well?
Lila had this passion and energy that turned her beauty into a living, breathing, pulsating entity. You couldn't help but be drawn in to watch, to want to be a part of it. I can't stay for dinner, he said.
Oh,
sorry. Something just came up.
You don't owe me an explanation.
I can come back later if you want. Layla studied his face. He wanted to tell her about Matthew and this Naomi situation, but after weighing the pros and cons, he'd decided that keeping his godson's confidence trumped informing on him to his mother. For today, anyway. For now. It was a close call, but Layla would understand. Maybe.
I have an early morning anyway, Layla said.
Got it.
And Matthew is out tonight. I don't know what time he'll get back.
Wild mimicked her in the gentlest way as he quoted her.
You don't owe me an explanation.
Layla gave him a smile.
Ah, what the hell. Come back if you can.
Might be late.
I don't care, she said. Then, you didn't tell me why you're using the front door.
I spotted Matthew on the street. Not a lie.
What did he say to you?
That he was going to a party at someone named Crash's house.
Crash Maynard, she said.
As in?
Yeah, the Maynard Manor, son of Dash.
Dash has a son named Crash?
His father loved the movie Bull Durham or something.
Can you believe that?
He shrugged.
When your name is Wild.
Touché. Darkness had fallen. The lullaby of crickets played, his constant, comforting companion.
I better go.
Wait. Layla dug into her jeans pocket. No need to play Mountain Man. She pulled out her key fob and tossed it to him. Take my car.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I may not be gone long.
I'll be here, Wild. Layla closed the door.
8 months ago, when Wild first encountered Ava O'Brien, she was living off Route 17 in a sprawling condo development of dull grays and beiges. That night, as they stumbled under popping fluorescent streetlights back to her place, Ava had made a joke about how the condos looked so much alike that she often stuck her key in the wrong door. Wild had no such issue. He still remembered the exact address and location. No one answered on the first knock. Wild knew the condo layout. He checked the window on the upper right. The light was on. That didn't mean much. He looked for a passing shadow. Nothing. He knocked again.
Shuffling feet.
A pause. It was nearly 9 p.m. now. Ava O'Brien was probably looking through the peephole. He stood and waited. A moment later, he heard a sliding chain. The knob turned.
Wild?
Ava wore a big terry cloth robe. He knew the robe. He'd even worn it. Can I come in for a second? He asked. He tried to read her face to see whether she was happy or sad to see him. Not that it would change anything. Her expression, however, seemed mixed. There was maybe surprise. There was maybe some joy. There was also something else, something in her expression that he couldn't quite put his finger on.
Now?
He didn't bother replying. Ava leaned forward, met his eye, and whispered,
I'm not alone, Wild.
Ah, so now he could quite put his finger on it. Her face softened.
Wild, she said in a voice too tender, why tonight?
Maybe he shouldn't have come. Maybe he should have left this to Hester. It's about Naomi Pine, he said. That got her attention.
She glanced behind her, stepped out onto the stoop, and closed the door behind her.
"What about Naomi?" she asked. "Is she okay?"
"She's missing."
"What do you mean, missing?"
"She's one of your students, right?"
"Sort of."
"What do you mean, sort of?"
"What do you mean she's missing?"
"Did you notice she's been absent?"
"I assumed she was sick."
Ava tightened the terrycloth robe.
"I don't understand. What's your interest in this?"
"I'm trying to find her."
"Why?"
When he didn't reply right away, Ava asked,
"Did you ask her father?"
"My colleague," easier than trying to explain about Hester, "did."
"And?"
"He claims that Naomi is with her mother."
"He said that?"
"Yes." Now Ava looked genuinely concerned.
"Naomi's mother hasn't been a part of her life for a long time."
"So we've been told."
"How did you end up coming to me?"
"A source," again easier, "claimed that you're close to her."
"I still don't understand. Why are you looking for Naomi? Did someone hire you?"
"No. I'm doing it as a favor."
"A favor for whom?"
"I can't tell you." "Do you have any idea where she is?" The door behind her opened. A big man with one of those super long beards filled the doorway. He looked at Ava, then at Wilde.
"Hi," he said.
"Hi," Wilde said. He looked back at Ava. "I better be going."
"No need," Wilde said. "This won't take long."
The bearded man looked at Ava some more, then, as if he'd seen an answer there, he nodded to himself. "Rain check?" he asked her.
"Sure."
He kissed her on the cheek, slapped Wilde on the back, and jogged down the steps. He slid into his GMC Terrain, headed out in reverse, and waved goodbye. Wilde turned back toward Ava and considered making an apology. She waved that away.
"Come on in."
Wilde sat on the same red couch where he and Ava had first kissed. He quickly scanned the room. Nothing much had changed since he'd spent those 3 days here with her. On one wall, there were two new paintings hung the slightest bit crookedly, one watercolor of what looked like a tormented face, one oil painting of the Hovenkopf Mountain, which wasn't far from here. "The paintings," he asked. "You do them?" She shook her head.
"Students."
He had figured that. She didn't like displaying her own work. Too personal, she'd told him when he asked. Too self-involved. Too easy to see all your flaws. "Either of them by Naomi?"
"No,"
Ava said. "But go ahead if you want."
"Go ahead and what?"
She gestured to the walls. "Straighten them. I know how antsy it's making you." At night, while Ava had slept, Wilde would go around, sometimes with a level, and make sure the paintings were indeed completely straight. It was one of the reasons why he was glad he had nothing hung up in his own abode. As Wilde started to adjust the paintings, Ava took a seat in the chair farthest away from him.
"You need to tell me why you're looking for her."
"No, I don't."
"Excuse me?"
He finished finagling with the mountain watercolor. "We don't have time for explanations. Do you trust me, Ava?" She pushed the hair back from her face.
"Should I?"
There may have been an edge in the tone, he couldn't be sure. Then, "Yes, Wilde, I trust you. Tell me about Naomi."
I don't know where she is, if that's what you're asking."
"But she's one of your students."
"She will be."
"What does that mean?" "I encouraged her to sign up for Intro to Watercolors next semester. She'll be my student then."
"But you already know her."
"Yes."
"How?"
"I do cafeteria duty 3 days a week. With the cutbacks, they were woefully understaffed." She leaned forward.
"You went to that high school, didn't you?"
"Yes."
"You're not going to believe this, but when the two of us were,
She looked up as though searching for the right word before shrugging and settling for,
"together, I had no idea who you were. I mean, about your past."
"I know."
"How?"
"I can always tell."
"People treat you differently, right?" "Never mind. It doesn't matter."
"I imagine you were an outcast at that place, right?"
"To some degree."
"To some degree," she repeated. "Because you're strong and attractive and probably athletic. Naomi is none of those things. She is that girl, Wilde, the full-on grade-A bullied outcast. Somehow, and this will sound awful, but there is something about her that makes it easier for people. Human nature that no one wants to discuss. There's a bit of us that enjoys the spectacle like she deserves it, and it's not just students. The other teachers smirk. I'm not saying they like it, but they do nothing to defend her. But you do. I try. It often makes it worse. I know that's a cop-out, but when I stood up for her, well, let's just say it didn't help. So what I do instead, I pretend she gets in trouble. I hope that maybe gives her cred or something. And part of her punishment is she can't sit in the cafeteria during lunch. I take her to the art studio. Sometimes, if I get out of cafeteria duty, I'll sit with her. I don't think it helped much with the students, but at least what? At least Naomi gets a break. At least she gets a few minutes of peace during the school day. Ava blinked away a tear. If Naomi is missing, she probably ran away. Why do you say that? Because her life is hell, even at home. I don't know if hell is the right word, but it isn't great there either. Do you know Naomi was adopted? Wilde shook his head. She talks about it more than an adopted kid should. In what way? Fantasizing about being rescued by her real parents, for example. Her adoptive parents had to go through all kinds of interviews and screenings, and when they passed, they were awarded an infant, Naomi. But then pretty much right away, the mom couldn't handle it. They even tried to return her to the orphanage. Do you believe that? Like she was a package delivered by UPS. Anyway, her mother had a breakdown, or claimed to. She abandoned Naomi and her father. Do you know where her mother is now? Oh, she's... Ava frowned and made air quotes with her fingers. Recovered. Remarried a rich guy. Naomi says she lives in a fancy townhouse on Park Avenue. Has Naomi said anything to you lately, anything that might help? No. Then, now that you mention it...
What?
She seemed a little better, more relaxed, calm. Wilde didn't say anything, but he didn't like that. Now it's your turn, Wilde. Why are you asking? Someone is worried about her. Who? I can't say. Matthew Krimstein? He said nothing. Like I said, Wilde, I didn't know who you were when we met.
But you know now.
Yes. Her eyes were suddenly bright with tears. He reached out and took her hands in his. She pulled away. He let her.
Wilde?
Yes. You need to find her. Wilde walked back to the condo parking lot. He drove Layla's BMW 20 yards to a dumpster. Hester had been correct. Layla was a slob, a beautiful slob. She kept her own self meticulously neat and clean and freshly showered, but her surroundings did not follow suit. The back seat of her BMW had coffee cups and protein bar wrappers. Wilde put the car in park and emptied it out. He wasn't a germaphobe, but he was glad that she had antibacterial lotion in the glove compartment. He looked back at Ava's house. Would she call back the big guy with the bigger beard? Doubt it. He didn't regret his time with Ava, not in the slightest. In fact, there had been a strange pang when he first saw her, something akin to longing. Maybe it was justification or rationalization, but the fact that he couldn't connect long-term didn't mean he didn't appreciate new experiences with new people. He never wanted to hurt them, but maybe it was even worse to patronize them or hand them some bullshit line. He settled on being completely truthful, not sugarcoating it, not being too faux protective. Wilde slept outside, even on those nights. It was hard to explain why, so sometimes he would leave a note, sneak back to the woods for a few hours, and then be back by the morning. Wilde couldn't fall asleep when someone else was with him. It was that simple. Outside, he dreamt a lot about his mother. Or maybe it wasn't his mother. Maybe it was another woman in that house with the red banister. He didn't know. but in the dream his mother, call her that for now, was beautiful, with long auburn hair and emerald eyes, and the voice of an angel. Was this what his mother really looked like? The image was a bit too perfect, perhaps more delusion than reality. It could be something he just conjured up or had even seen on TV. Memory makes demands that you often can't keep. Memory is faulty because it insists on filling in the blanks. His phone rang. It was Hester.
"Did you talk to Ava O'Brien?" Hester asked.
"Yes."
"Are you proud of me for not prying about how you know her?"
"You're a model of discretion."
"So what did she say?"
Wilde filled her in. When he finished, she said,
"That part about Naomi seeming calm, that's not good."
"I know," Wilde said. "When people decide to end their lives, they often exhibit a sense of calm. The decision has been made. A weight, oddly enough, has been lifted."
"Well, I have news," Hester said, "and it's not good."
Wilde waited.
"The mother called me back. She has no idea where Naomi is."
"So the father lied," Wilde said.
"Maybe."
Either way, it wouldn't hurt for Wilde to pay the dead a visit. Someone called out to Hester. There was some commotion in the background. "All okay?" he asked.
"I'm about to go live on air," Hester said. "Wilde?"
"Yes."
"We need to do something fast. Agreed?"
"It could still be nothing."
"Is that what your gut is telling you?"
"I don't listen to my gut," Wilde said. "I listen to the facts."
"Bullshit." "Then, are the facts worried about this girl?"
"This girl," he agreed. "And Matthew." There was more commotion.
"Gotta go, Wilde. We'll talk soon."
She hung up.
Hester sat at the news desk on a leather-backed stool, set a tad too high for her. Her toes barely touched the floor. The teleprompter was lined up and ready to roll. Lori, the on-duty hairstylist, was working some final touches which involved two-finger plucking, while Brian, the makeup artist, added some last-second concealer. The red countdown clock, which resembled the timer on a TV drama bomb, indicated that they had under 2 minutes until air. Her co-host for tonight played on his phone. Hester closed her eyes for a second, felt the makeup brush stroke her cheek, felt the fingers gently pull her hair into place. It was all oddly soothing. When her phone vibrated, she opened her eyes with a sigh and shooed Lori and Brian away. She normally wouldn't take a call this close to going on air, but the caller ID told her it was her grandson.
"Matthew?
Did you find her yet?"
His voice was a desperate hush.
"Why are you whispering? Where are you?"
"At Crash's house."
"Did you speak to Naomi's mother?"
"Yes."
"What did she say?"
"She doesn't know where Naomi is." Her grandson made a sound that might have been a groan.
"Matthew, what aren't you telling us?"
"It doesn't matter."
"It does."
His tone turned sullen.
"Forget I asked, okay?" "Not okay."
One of the producers yelled, 10 seconds to air!" Her co-host pocketed his phone and sat up straight. He turned to Hester, saw she had the phone pressed against her ear, and said,
Hester, you're doing the intro?"
The producer held up his hand to indicate 5 seconds. He tucked his thumb to show it was now 4.
"I'll call you back," Hester said.
She put the phone on the table in front of her as the producer dropped his index finger. 3 seconds may seem like a very short time. In television terms, it's not. Hester had time to glance at Allison Grant, her segment producer, and nod. Allison had time to make a face and nod back so as to indicate that she would comply with Hester's request, but she would do so reluctantly. Still, Hester had prepared for this. There were times you investigated, and there were times you instigated. It was time for the latter. The producer finished his countdown and pointed at Hester.
"Good evening," Hester said, "and welcome to this edition of Crimstein on Crime. Our lead story tonight is, what else? Upstart presidential candidate Rusty Eggers and the controversy surrounding his campaign."
That part was on the teleprompter. The rest was not. Hester took a deep breath.
In for a penny, in for a... "But first,
"Breaking news just coming in," Hester said.
Her co-host frowned and turned toward her. The thing was, Matthew was scared. That was what Hester couldn't shake. Matthew was scared, and he had asked for her help. How could she not do all she could? A photograph of Naomi Pine filled television screens across the country. It was the only photograph her producer, Allison Grant, had been able to find, and that had taken some doing. There was nothing on social media, which was really strange in today's society, but Allison, who was as good as they came, dug up the website for the school photographer who took the official Sweetwater High portraits. Once Allison promised that they would keep the watermark with his logo on it, the photographer had agreed to let them use it on air. Hester continued, "Tonight, a local girl from Westville, New Jersey, is missing and needs your help." From the parking lot outside Ava's condo, Wilde weighed his options. There really wasn't much more to do when he thought about it. The hour was getting late, so option one. He could just drive back to Layla's house and gently pad upstairs to the bedroom where she'd be waiting, and... yeah, did he really have to review other options? To cover his bases, he texted Matthew. "Where are you?" "Matthew, at Crash Maynard's." Layla had told him that earlier, but he wasn't sure he was supposed to know. Wilde, "Is Naomi there?" "Matthew, no." Wilde debated what to type next, but then he saw the dots dancing, indicating that Matthew was typing. "Matthew, shit." Wilde, "What?" "Matthew, something bad is going down." Wilde's thumbs didn't move as fast as he wanted them to, but he finally managed to type, "Like what?" No reply. Wilde, "Hello?" The utopian image from option one, Layla upstairs in that bedroom, warm under the covers, reading legal briefs, rose up in front of him so real he could smell her skin. Wilde, "Matthew?" No reply. The Layla-related image turned to smoke and drifted into the ether. Damn. Wilde started up the road toward Maynard Manor. Chapter 7. Matthew was in Crash Maynard's enormous mansion on the hill. The mansion's exterior looked old and kind of gothic with marble columns. It reminded Matthew of that snooty golf club his grandmother took him to because one of her clients was getting some kind of award. Hester hadn't liked being there, he remembered. As she sucked down the wine, too much wine as it turned out, her eyes began to narrow. She glanced around the room, frowning and muttering under her breath about silver spoons and privilege and inbreeding. When he asked her what was wrong, Hester had looked her grandson up and down and said, loud enough for those nearby to hear, "You're half Jew, half black. You'd doubly not be allowed in this club." Then she paused, raised a finger in the air, and added, "Or maybe you'd be two tokens in one." When an elderly lady with frozen dollops of snow-white hair made a tut-tut-shh noise in her direction, Hester had told her to blow it out her ass. That was Matthew's grandmother. Nana never avoided a controversy if she could create one. It was both mortifying and comforting. Mortifying, well, that was pretty obvious. Comforting, because he knew that his grandmother always had his back. He never questioned it. Didn't matter that she was small or 70 or whatever. His grandmother seemed superhuman to him. There were about a dozen kids at what parents insisted on calling a party, but was really just a gathering in Crash's lower level. Crash's parents didn't like calling it a basement, which may have been the coolest place Matthew had ever been. If the exterior was old school, the interior couldn't have been more state-of-the-art. The home theater was closer to a full-fledged cinema with mod digital sound design and 40-plus seats. There was a cherrywood bar and real theater popcorn machine out front. The corridors were lined with a mix of vintage movie posters and posters for Crash's dad's television shows. The arcade room was a mini replica of the Silver Ball, the famed pinball palace on the Asbury Park boardwalk. Down one corridor was a wine cellar with oak barrels,
The other became an underground tunnel leading to a regulation-sized basketball court, a replica, lots of replicas, of the Knicks floor at Madison Square Garden. No one ever hung out on the basketball court. No one ever used the pinball arcade. No one was ever really in the mood to watch anything in the movie theater. Not that Matthew had been here a lot. For most of his life, he'd been on the outs with the popular crowd, but recently, Matthew had wormed his way back in. Truth be told, he loved it here. The popular kids did the coolest things, like when Crash had that birthday bash in Manhattan. His dad had rented black limos to transport them, and the party had been in some huge place that used to be a bank. All the boys got to be escorted in by past contestants on Dash Maynard's reality show Hot Models in Lingerie. A famous TV star had DJ'd the party, and when he introduced my best friend and our birthday boy, Crash had ridden in on a white horse, a real horse, and then his father drove in behind him in a red Tesla he'd given his son as a present. Tonight, most of the kids had ended up in the regular TV room, a 98-inch Samsung 4K Ultra HD hanging on the wall. Crash and Kyle played Madden video football. The rest of the gang, Luke, Mason, Caitlin, Darla, Ryan, and of course Sutton, always Sutton, lay sprawled across upscale beanbag chairs as though some giant being had tossed them from the sky. Most of his friends were high. Caleb and Brianna had gone off to a room down the corridor to take their hookup to the next level. The room was dark. The blue light from both the television and individual smartphones illuminating his classmates' faces, turning them a ghostly pale. Sutton was on the right, uncharacteristically on her own. Matthew wanted to take advantage of that opening, and so he looked for a way to move closer to her. He'd had an unrequited crush on Sutton since seventh grade. Sutton, with the almost supernatural poise and blonde hair and perfect skin, and melt-your-bones smile. And she was always nice and friendly, and a sixth-degree black belt in how to keep guys like Matthew in the friend zone. On the big screen, Crash's video quarterback threw a deep pass that went for a touchdown. Crash jumped up, did a little celebration dance, and shouted at Kyle, "In your face!" This led to some half-hearted laughs from the spectators, all of whom were on their phones. Crash looked around as though he'd expected more in the way of a reaction, but it wasn't happening. Not tonight, anyway. There was something in the room, a whiff of fear or desperation. "We need more munchies?" Crash asked. No one responded. "Come on, who's with me?" The half-hearted murmurs were enough. Crash hit a button on the intercom. A woman's Mexican-accented voice said, "Yes, Mr. Crash? Can we get some nachos and quesadillas, Rosa?" "Of course, Mr. Crash." "And can you crush up some of that homemade guac?" "Of course, Mr. Crash." On the screen, Crash kicked off. Luke and Mason drank beers. Caitlin and Ryan shared a joint, while Darla vaped with the latest flavors from Juul. The room had been Crash's dad's cigar room, and they had done something to it so you couldn't really smell the new smoke. Caitlin passed an e-cigarette to Sutton. Sutton took it, but she didn't put it in her mouth. Kyle said, "Oh, man, I love Rose's guac. Right?" Crash and Kyle high-fived, and then someone, maybe Mason, forced up a laugh. Luke joined in, then Caitlin, then pretty much everyone, except Matthew and Sutton. Matthew didn't know what they were all laughing about. Rose's guacamole? But the sound had zero authenticity, like they were all trying too hard to be normal. Mason said, "She check in on the app?" Silence. "I was just saying, there's nothing," Crash said, interrupting him. "I got an app that gives updates." More silence. Matthew slipped out of the room. He headed toward the relative privacy of the nearby wine cellar. When he closed the door behind him, he sat on a barrel that read Maynard Vineyards. Yes, they owned a vineyard too, and called his grandmother.
"Matthew, did you find her yet?"
"Why are you whispering? Where are you?"
"At Crash's house. Did you speak to Naomi's mother?"
"Yes."
Matthew felt his heart beating in his chest.
What did she say?
She doesn't know where Naomi is. He closed his eyes and groaned.
Matthew, what aren't you telling us?
Doesn't matter.
It does.
But he couldn't say anything. Not yet.
Forget I asked, okay?
Not okay. Through the phone, he heard a male voice say,
10 seconds to air.
Then someone else mumbled something he couldn't make out.
I'll call you back,
Hester said before disconnecting the call. As he took the phone away from his ear, a familiar voice said,
Hey.
He turned to the wine cellar entrance. It was Sutton. She was still blinking away the dark of the TV room.
Hey, he said.
Sutton had a bottle of beer in her hand.
You want some?
He shook his head, afraid that Sutton would think it was gross to share his germs or something. Then again, hadn't she asked him? Sutton looked around the wine cellar as if she'd never seen it before, though she'd always been with the popular crowd. Always.
What are you doing in here? She asked.
Matthew shrugged.
I don't know. You don't seem yourself tonight.
It surprised him that Sutton would notice something like that. He shrugged again. Man, did he know how to woo girls or what?
Then Sutton said, She's fine, you know.
Just like that.
Matthew?
Do you know where she is?
No, but...
Now it was her turn to shrug. His phone buzzed. He sneaked a peek. Where are you?
It was from Wild.
Matthew quickly texted back, At Crash Maynard's. Is Naomi there?
No.
Sutton stepped toward him.
They're a little worried about you.
Who? Crash and Kyle, the others? She looked at him with those blue eyes.
Me too.
I'm fine. Now her phone buzzed. When she read it, her eyes widened.
Oh my God.
What?
She looked up at him with those gorgeous eyes. Did you?
He heard a commotion from down the corridor. Matthew typed, Shit. Wild.
What?
Crash burst into the wine cellar as Matthew hit send on, Something bad is going down. Kyle came in right behind him. They both had their smartphones in their hands. Crash stormed toward Matthew so fast that Matthew actually put his fists up as though preparing to ward off a blow. Crash stopped, raised his hands in a surrender motion, and smiled. The smile was oily. Matthew felt something roil in the pit of his stomach.
Whoa, whoa,
Crash said in a voice that aimed for comforting, but slithered down Matthew's back like a snake.
Let's slow down here.
Crash Maynard was surface handsome. Wavy dark hair, brooding boy band expression, thin frame adorned in the latest fashion. When you took a closer look at him, you could see that Crash was nothing special. Not in any way, really, but as Hester once joked about a rich girl she wanted Matthew to date, she's beautiful when she's standing on her money. Crash always wore a big, silver smile skull ring. It looked ridiculous on his thin, smooth finger. With that oily smile still on his face, Crash lifted his phone and turned it toward Matthew.
Do you want to explain this?
He pushed down on the screen using the finger with the smile skull ring. The ring seemed to wink at Matthew. A video sprang to life, starting off with the familiar network news logo. Then his grandmother came on the screen.
But first, breaking news just coming in.
A photo of Naomi appeared on the screen.
Tonight, a local girl from Westville, New Jersey is missing and needs your help. Naomi Pine has been missing for at least a week now. There have been no reported sightings or ransom demands, but friends are concerned that the teen may be in danger.
Oh, no. Matthew felt his stomach tumble. He hadn't thought about that, that Nana might go live on the air with the story. Or was that what he'd secretly been hoping? He wasn't surprised by how fast the news, according to the timer on the app, less than 2 minutes, had disseminated amongst his friends. That was how it worked now. Someone maybe had a news alert on Naomi Pine, or maybe a parent had seen the story and right away texted their kid and said, Doesn't this girl go to your school? Or maybe someone followed CNN on Twitter, whatever. That was how it was now, how quickly word got out. Crash's smile didn't flicker.
That's your grandmother, right?
Yeah, but... Crash beckoned for more with his smile skull ring hand.
But?
Matthew said nothing. Crash's tone was mocking.
Did you say something to Grandma?
What? Matthew tried to look offended by the suggestion.
No, of course not.
Still smiling, a smile that now eerily echoed the one on his ring, Crash stepped forward and put his hands on Matthew's shoulders. Then, without the slightest warning, he drove his knee upward straight into Matthew's groin. Crash pulled down on Matthew's shoulders for extra leverage. The blow lifted Matthew onto his toes. The pain was immediate, white-hot, all-consuming. Tears filled Matthew's eyes. Every part of his body shut down. His knees caved, and he collapsed to the floor. The pain rose from his stomach, paralyzing his lungs. Matthew pulled his knees to his chest and curled himself into a fetal ball on the floor. Crash bent down so his mouth was right near Matthew's ear.
Do you think I'm stupid?
Matthew's cheek was pressed against the floorboard. He still couldn't breathe. It felt as if some part of him was irretrievably broken, as if he would never be right again.
You drove here with Luke and Mason. They told me you were standing with your grandmother when they picked you up.
Breathe, Matthew told himself. Try to breathe.
What did you tell her, Matthew?
He gritted his teeth and managed to open his eyes. Kyle was by the door on lookout.
Sutton was nowhere to be seen. Had she set him up? Would she really do that to...
No. Sutton couldn't know the story was about to come out or any of that. And she wouldn't...
Matthew?
He looked up, the pain still ripping through him.
We could kill you and get away with it. You know that, right?
Matthew stayed frozen. Crash made a fist and showed him the silver skull.
What did you tell your grandmother?
Chapter 8. Two floors above the wine cellar, in a circular turret on the western wing of the massive estate, Dash Maynard and his wife Delia sat in burgundy leather wingback armchairs in front of an oversized fireplace with ceramic white birch logs and gas-fed flames. This room, an addition they'd put on 3 years ago, was the Beauty and the Beast library and featured floor-to-ceiling built-in oak bookshelves with a rolling ladder on copper rails. Dash Maynard read a biography on Teddy Roosevelt. He loved history, always had, though he had no interest, thank you very much, in being a part of it. Before he hit it huge with the both famous and infamous self-help talk show, The Rusty Show, and then in a new genre that the networks dubbed upscale gameality, an awkward blend of game show and reality, Dash Maynard had been an award-winning documentary filmmaker. He'd won an Emmy for his searing PBS short on the Nanking Massacre of 1937. Dash loved research and interviews and on-location filming, but he'd excelled in the editing room, able to take countless hours of video and turn it into a compelling narrative. Delia Reese Maynard, the chair of the political science department at nearby Reston College, read through student essays. Dash liked to watch her when his wife read student papers, the furrow of the brow, the thinning of her lips, the slow nod when she got excited about a section. Over the summer, Dash and Delia, double D's, some jokingly called them, had celebrated their 25th wedding anniversary by taking their 16-year-old son Crash and their 14-year-old twin daughters Kira and Kara on their yacht through the Baltics. During the day, they'd set down the anchor in a secluded island cove to swim and jet ski and wakeboard. In the afternoons and evenings, they toured ports of call like St. Petersburg and Stockholm and Riga. It had been a marvelous trip. Dash thought of that time now, that family vacation away from this damn country, as the calm before the storm. They were lucky people. He knew that. People liked to classify them as Hollywood elites, but Dash had been born and raised in a modest three-family townhouse
in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn. Both his parents had taught at Hunter College's main campus in Manhattan. Dash's name came from his father's favorite author, Dashiell Hammett. He and Delia first bonded, really bonded, over old mystery novels when they browsed first editions of Raymond Chandler, Agatha Christie, Ningayo Marsh, and of course Dashiell Hammett at a used bookstore in Washington, D.C. At the time, the two barely paid political interns working on Capitol Hill couldn't afford any first editions. Now, this very room housed one of the greatest collections in the world. As they say, life comes at you fast. Dash and Delia had spent the last 10 years since Dash's production company had really hit it big with a primetime show where big-name celebrities disguise themselves as ordinary Americans and live amongst them for 6 months, trying to balance the fame and money thing with the core values of family and study that they both revered. It was a constantly evolving calibration. The balance had worked, for the most part. Sure, Crash was a little spoiled and acted out, while Kira had some mild issues with depression, but that seemed to be the norm today. As a couple, Dash and Delia could not have been closer. That was why nights like this, his son throwing a small party downstairs while his parents enjoyed the quiet of each other, meant so much to them. Dash loved this. He reveled in it. He wanted to live the rest of his life this way. But he couldn't. There was a knock on the library door. Gavin Chambers, a former Marine colonel who now worked in the ever-expanding private security industry, stepped into the room before Dash had a chance to say, "Come in." Chambers still looked the longtime Marine, the buzz cut, the ramrod posture, the steady gaze. "What's the matter?" Dash asked. Chambers looked over at Delia as though maybe it would be best if the little lady left. Dash frowned. Delia didn't move. "Go on," Dash said. "A television report just aired," Chambers said. "There's a young girl missing. Her name is Naomi Pine." Dash looked at Delia. Delia shrugged. "And?" "Naomi goes to school with Crash. They are in several classes together. I'm still not sure she's been communicating with your son. Texts, mostly. Also, the journalist who reported her missing just now, her name is Hester Krimstein. Her grandson, Matthew, is downstairs with Crash." Delia put the student papers down on the side table. "I still don't see how this connects to us, Colonel." Chambers said,
"Neither do I.
So,
yet."
Then for emphasis, Chambers repeated the sentence,
"Neither do I yet."
He stood at attention and stared straight ahead.
"But with all due respect, I don't believe in coincidences, especially right now."
"What do you think we should do about it?"
"I think we need to talk to your son and figure out his relationship to Naomi."
His phone buzzed. He put it to his ear with a snap, almost as though he were saluting a superior officer.
"Yes?"
After 3 seconds, Gavin Chambers pocketed the phone.
"Don't leave this room," he told them. "There's been an incident."
Racing along Skyline Drive toward Maynard Manor. Man, what a pompous name. Wilde hoped to feel his phone buzz with another text from Matthew. It didn't. The last text just kept coming back to Wilde, taunting him. "Something bad is going down." Wilde might not go with his gut. That was what he'd told Hester. But as he turned into the manor's driveway, every instinct told him he should pay heed to that message. Something bad is going down. Maynard Manor sat atop 30 acres of disputed mountain the Ramapo people claimed as their own. There were barns for 12 horses and a track for steeplejumping and a pool and a tennis court and who knew what else. The centerpiece was an enormous classical revival Georgian home built by an oil tycoon in the Roaring Twenties. The upkeep on the 35-room estate had been so steep that the manor had fallen into disrepair for nearly a quarter century until Dash Maynard, mega television producer and cable network owner, and his wife Delia swept in and brought the place back to its former splendor, and then some. From the ornate gate where Wilde had to stop, The manor house was still a solid quarter-mile drive up the mountain. Wilde could see some distant lights, but that was about it. He pressed the intercom button while checking his phone, hoping maybe he just didn't feel the buzz. Nothing from Matthew. He sent another text. "I'm at the guard gate." "May I help you?" the intercom said. Wilde had his driver's license out. He held it up to the camera. "I'm here from Matthew Krimstein." Silence. "Matthew's a friend of Crash's." "What is your relationship to him?"
"To Matthew?"
"Yes."
"Odd question."
"I'm his godfather."
"And what is the purpose of your visit?"
"I'm here to pick him up." "He arrived in Mason Perdue's vehicle. We were told that he was leaving with him."
"Well, the plans have changed."
Silence. Wilde said,
"Hello. One moment, please."
Time passed. Wilde hit the intercom button again. No reply. He pressed down on the button and held it down. Nothing. He checked for wires near the gate. None. The fence had no electrocution set up. That was good. It was high with spiked tops, but none of that would be an issue. There were security cameras, of course, lots of them. That didn't matter to him either. If anything, he wanted to be seen. Wilde threw the car into park and stepped out. He eyed the gate. 12 feet high, he guessed. Bars spaced 6 inches apart. The seam where both halves of the metal gate met would be the way to go. Thicker bar, get a running start, just up and over. Wilde had spent his life climbing mountain, trees, rocks, walls, as a child, as a civilian, as a soldier. This gate, even with the spikes on top of every bar, would offer him little resistance. He took 2 large steps toward the gate when he heard the voice from the speaker say, "Halt! Do not!" He didn't hear the rest. Wilde leapt, his foot hitting the bar in mid-stride. He hoisted himself up as though running vertically, grabbed the bars with both hands and tucked his legs. He spun, let go with his left hand, and put his feet out. The soles of his shoes hit the bars on the other side, slowing him. He let go and dropped to the ground as 2 cars sped toward him. Not 1 car, 2. That seemed like overkill. Or maybe not. Dash Maynard had been in the news lately. Rumor had it, a rumor Dash Maynard adamantly denied, that he videoed everything when people were on his shows, including conversations in the dressing rooms. Rumor further had it that these videos could take down a lot of top celebrities and politicians, most notably former self-help guru and current United States Senator Rusty Eggers, the budding tyrant running for president and gaining ground. Both cars pointed their headlights at him and screeched to a stop. 4 men, 2 from each car, got out. Wilde kept his hands out where they could see them. The last thing he wanted was for someone to do something stupid. The 2 from his left, big men, began to approach him. They both had their chests puffed out, their arms swinging with a little too much alpha preening. One wore a hoodie. The other, the one sporting dyed Thor locks, had a suit jacket that didn't fit well. Didn't fit well, Wilde noted, because he had a gun holster under the left armpit. Wilde had known too many guys like these two. They wouldn't be an issue except for the weapon. He braced himself, sifting through his options. But the man who got out of the car on the right, close-cropped gray hair, military bearing, held up a hand and stopped them, clearly the leader.
"Hey there," gray hair shouted to Wilde. "Nice fence hop."
"Thanks."
"Please keep your hands visible at all times."
"I'm not armed."
"We can't let you go any farther."
"I don't have any interest in going any farther," Wilde said. "I'm here for my godson, Matthew Krimstein."
"I understand, but we have a policy."
"Policy?"
"All the miners who entered tonight had to inform us of how they were leaving," he began, the very voice of reason. "We clearly explained to them that no one is allowed in unless they are specifically invited or properly vetted. Matthew Krimstein came in with Mason Perdue. That was who Matthew told us he would be leaving with. Now, you show up unannounced."
He spread his hands. Not only the voice of reason, but the very essence of reason.
"Do you see our dilemma?"
"So contact Matthew."
We have a policy about not disturbing social gatherings.
Lots of policies, Wilde said.
Helps keep the order.
I want to see my godson.
I'm afraid that won't be possible at this time.
The gate behind him opened.
I'm going to have to ask you to leave now.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Grayhair might have smiled.
I'm going to ask you one more time.
Matthew texted me to pick him up now, so that's what I'm doing.
If you'll just go back to the other side of the gate,
yeah, again,
that's not happening.
The big guys didn't like Wilde's attitude. They furrowed their rather enormous brows. Dyed Thor turned to Grayhair, hoping for permission to take this to the next level.
You have no legal standing, Mr. Wilde.
The use of his name threw him, but only for a millisecond. He'd shown his driver's license at the gate.
You're not the boy's father, are you?
Grayhair smiled. He knew the answer, more specifically than just